With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hiya, I'm Christina from Tāmaki Makaurau, Aotearoa, New Zealand. And you're listening to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, what is something that you thought you knew but had utterly wrong? Okie dokie, here comes the show. And remember, question everything.
Hello everybody, welcome to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dame Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer.
Hello.
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked. And we're talking everything from...
We are talking everything from Christina from New Zealand's question. Oh, that's good, isn't it? New Zealand. What is something you thought you knew that was actually wrong? Now, that's quite a clever question.
Very good question.
Makes me think about how I used to not like olives. And then and then in later life, not particularly profound one, that one, I'd say, but, you know.
So it's just a slight change to your palate is the only thing you've been wrong about, Howard.
Well, I didn't like the stones, but the olive without the stones, whoa, love an olive. Probably not what you were looking for, Christina, I imagine, was my changing life of olives, but, you know, there you go.
So I would say, I mean, there are so many things, but I'd say... Probably one of the biggest things would be I thought I knew that Pluto was a planet in our solar system and then found out it most definitely wasn't, which is very interesting. And I think it's... And because of that, Christina, it's taught me the virtue of being open to new ideas and that most truths are matters of perception. And also facts can be retested, especially scientifically. So you can always measure... theory again.
There you go, so, Christina. Yeah. Hope that answers your question. And suffice to say, on this podcast, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we, Dave?
Absolutely. And at the time that we answer them, we usually think they're right, but we're open to them being wrong as well. With that being said, if you do like the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify and you'll never miss an episode. Or you can subscribe to us on Acast, the world's biggest podcast network, where you can hear all of the very special questions being asked and answered by our very special guests. With that being said, on today's show is a British political commentator, policy advisor, and campaigner. He is the senior fellow at the Research Institute Policy Exchange, a centre-right to right-wing think tank. He was the Brexit Party candidate in Broxtow, but dropped out to support the Conservative candidate, and has also held various positions in political organisations and campaigns, including Defund the BBC, Unite to Leave, and the Conservative Way Forward. He is also a regular contributor to the Daily Mail, Daily Telegraph, and GB News. Please welcome to the show Mr. Calvin Robinson.
What a lovely introduction. Thank you very much, Dave.
Was that nice? Was it? Do you enjoy it?
Sometimes I forget all the stuff I've done, so it's nice having it reeled off in that way.
Well, I feel like, you should have your work chronicled. I guess, depending on whose ideological or political disposition, celebrated. So it varies from person to person.
Not all of our listeners are going to be high-fiving about those things there, Calvin, I think. But that's why you're here, right?
That being said, I should probably include Calvin, and I'm sure you'll be fine with this. Also, devout Christian and man of God. I should probably include that as well.
That should be the first thing.
Interesting point. And interestingly, leads to an interesting point about intersectionality. Because I would say, obviously, I've done some research, Calvin, and I'm somewhat aware of your work. I'd say your narrative is interesting because obviously there's a lot of connotations to someone who is a regular columnist in the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph. But it's very interesting to see that your theological disposition is what you like to lead with more than your political or ideological one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you always been a Christian?
I haven't always been a Christian, no. Well, not in the way that I am now, at least. Mm-hmm. I've always been in search of my faith. It's been a long journey. Mm-hmm. It took me a long time to get here, but I've always been, I don't like the word spiritual, but I suppose that's the best way to put it. I didn't have an organized religion for all of my life, but I've always, you know, prayed and all of that. But I do try to center my life around my faith. I think you know, you mentioned intersectionality and, you know, identity is a very prevalent thing at the moment. The core of my identity is Christianity, and everything else comes after that. And I try to, you know, my politics, my what kind of music I listen to, everything comes from my trying to organize my life towards living a life in Christ, which is why I always find it fascinating when people say it's, you know, right wing or center right wing or whatever. I'm not. I'm just trying to live by Christian values. And you know, you listed off these newspapers that I've written for. You know, they don't dictate. The papers don't dictate my policies. It's more like they are. They just happen to be the ones that are most open minded. I've written for the Guardian only once, but you know, papers on the left don't tend to be as open minded or want to hear from a broad spectrum as papers like the Telegraph and the Daily Mail. That's what I find anyway.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting point, and fair enough. And I mean, I would say as well, so far as the landscape, as I say, the editorial and discursive landscape of podcasts, I imagine you may have encountered the same kind of adversity as well. We make it a point of principle and question everything to do what we say on the tin, which is question everything. And as I said, friends and colleagues have both recommended that we invite you to conversation. So
so with that in mind, it's probably time for a question, isn't it, Dane, as the format of this show dictates?
Thank you, Howard. A very polite way of saying that I've spoken enough. And Calvin, the floor is yours, essentially. As our esteemed guest, we invite you to ask the first question, which can be any question you'd like, which Howard and I would like to discuss with you for about 15 minutes. Howard would then like to also pose you a question, which we'd like to discuss at the same time. And in straight linear fashion, I would like to do the same thing and pose a question to you to discuss for 15 minutes. And following our discussion, if it would please you to tell our listeners where they can find out more about your work and narratives and see more of the dimensions to the God-loving and fearing Calvin Robinson. How does that sound?
Sounds good to me.
Cool. Well, the floor is yours, sir, to ask the first question.
Okay, so it's kind of a two-parter, I suppose, but... what do you believe freedom to mean? And are we a people that cares about freedom?
What inspired this question, Calvin?
Well, the current climate, because I find that, I've always thought that the British people were a people that believed in, you know, civil liberties and an individual's right to live their life as they see fit. You know, an Englishman's home is his castle. Invite whoever you want around, discuss whatever you like. But all of these things are changing. Some of them because of COVID. So we've had restrictions on who you're allowed to invite into your own home. Some of these things are changing because of politics. So in Scotland, you know, you can be arrested in your own home for saying something that other people find offensive, or this whole hate crime, hate speech situation. The way we see ourselves as free beings is changing. Where we're allowed to go, how long we're allowed outside our home, who we're allowed to spend time with. All of these things have limits now, and they never have before. But I'm worried that I don't think people care. Or I don't think a lot of people care. I think people care more about their security. And I find that fascinating, because if you give up freedom for the sake of security, are you still free?
It's a good question. And I imagine, and I think the last 18 months have definitely been a catalyst for this discussion about personal and civil freedoms, which I find very interesting, particularly... you know, as I said, you know, I actually feel like, and I guess when I think about freedom, I do it from a philosophical position, where I guess I would have to ponder when I'd seen a state of freedom in the first place to know whether or not it'd been taken away. And I say that, I suppose, with, I'll take the example of, let's say, enterprise or like free market economics, where, you know, the idea within a free market is that if you have an idea and or a product or service, you should be able to enter in a free market of commerce and be able to exchange your good or service for monetary value. But governments tend to oversee a lot of that, whereby you may require a vending license, you may require a license to sell a particular product like a spirit. And so you may not necessarily be completely free. And another example, I guess, would be a lot of the time in these more intense discussions we have about political ideology or religion, a lot of the time if people say something that, you know, the group at large don't... So let's say, for example, what may be referred to as the woke left may object to statements made by particular people in the public eye. And the rebuttal is, well, that person has freedom of speech. I would say, has there ever been freedom of speech? Because we have regulatory bodies such as Ofcom, and we have laws such as libel laws, which exist for the sole reason to curtail or reprimand people who are reckless with said speech. So freedom to me, I guess, would be the freedom of expression, whether it be ideologically or politically, freedom of movement to go and visit friends and, you know, family, or travel between borders. But I'd say that I don't know if we've ever had a state of freedom, because the freedom of movement is obviously curtailed by the fact that we have border forces and border controls, which means that you can't freely move between countries. So I don't know if we've ever been free, Calvin, I guess, is the short answer I have. So would you have examples where you could see, utopia is a bit of a reach, but could you describe a state whereby you would say you've observed what would be the closest things to individual and civil freedoms within a society or a country?
Yeah, so I would say we've always been free. You know, you mentioned, have we ever been free because we have borders? If we didn't have borders, we wouldn't have countries. So if we didn't have countries, we wouldn't have freedom, because we wouldn't have laws. We wouldn't have laws of the land. And the reason we've always been free in this country is because the law of the land has by default been common law, in that you're free to do whatever you please unless it's explicitly curtailed in the law, which is opposed to countries like America, where you're free to do what is said in the law. We have the inverse system. So I've said, I think by default, we've always been free. And more now, probably over the last 5 years or so, we've seen different freedoms being adjusted for the sake of, always well-intentioned, for the sake of good things. Like you just mentioned, not wanting to libel someone or not wanting to cause offence. And we've gone down a slippery slope of, well, what does offence mean? What can be said? Who decides what's hurtful or harmful? Who decides what we're allowed to say? And you mentioned Ofcom as well. I think they're a very dangerous body. They were set up for a good purpose, to ensure that the media has balance, but I don't think that is what they're doing at the moment. I think they're stifling free speech in a lot of ways. One of the updates from Ofcom last year, around the peak of COVID, was that broadcast media should not question or undermine public health bodies. And I find that very disturbing, the idea that you shouldn't question. Oh, undermine, sure, I get that, but shouldn't be able to question public health bodies. It's this idea that there's one approved narrative, we all must follow it, whether that's the government narrative or it's the social narrative around sex, gender, race, whatever. It seems to me in our society at the moment, all aspects of our lives, there is an approved narrative that we must adhere to. And if you stray from it, you're cancelled or you're ostracised or you're a bad person. And I think, you know, you sound like someone who believes in open debate and exchange of ideas and the free marketplace of ideas as well as goods. And I think that's important. We need more of that. But I think we're heading in the opposite direction.
I think it's interesting that you've said a couple of times, you mentioned country and, you know, kind of the laws of the... And I think that is the actual problem or the kind of cause of a lot of the friction we're facing, which is there was a period for 20th century history where being in your country was the predominant thing. But every day now, you are no longer in your country because of the internet. The internet has completely evolved our perspective on the world. You know, I've got nieces and nephews growing up with the internet, and that changes your landscape. It's an international landscape, right, Dane, which instantly shifts what you think is the kind of the influences that you can have.
Well, I'd say digitally the world's become smaller and borders don't exist within a digital world. To think of a more physical, a tangible example as well, I'd say maybe former Yugoslavia, for example. Within that, as a larger nation, would there have been freedom of movement for Slavic peoples, and following the dissolution of Yugoslavia into smaller nations and those borders being formed, those freedoms would have changed. But would the state of those people changed despite the civil or political unrest that led to them forming other nations? Because I do take on board what you're saying about like borders, and if there was no borders, then, you know, people could move anywhere. But then I think, if we are, and I guess I'm posing this as a question, if we are trying to approach a point where we do observe our most freedoms, how necessary are borders, in the sense that, you know, we live in a world of global capitalism and a global market where currency is able to move between borders without any kind of barriers other than maybe exchange rates and exchange markets. So being that capitalism is a system of labor being used to generate capital, does it not stand to reason that if money crosses borders, then people must inevitably do the same in order to, you know, realize economic opportunities or exploit potential free markets? Shouldn't someone with a good idea have the freedom to do so? Like, say, for example, if Elon Musk wanted to relocate his business to the UK, would we want protectionist policies or any kind of border control to prevent him from entering?
No, I would love Elon Musk to come over here and fix our transport system. I've been saying that for a long time. But we absolutely need borders, and borders are vital. Borders are so important because borders define us. So you can only have a community if there is another. You cannot have a community without another. We are defined naturally by the other. So that's how we understand what we stand for. So borders enable us to have values, community, engagement. So for example, British values, we know, are not universal. We know there are many places around the world that don't agree with our values of, you know, people, democracy, rule of law, tolerance of people with different faiths and non, people's right to live their lives as long as they see fit, as long as they're not harming other people. All of these things we see as pretty much, we take for granted, but there are lots of places around the world that do not support those values, and we won't have to name them, we can think of them. So borders enable us to define those kind of things and say, actually, everyone's welcome here, or certain people are welcome here, as long as you say, as long as you subscribe to the values that we are adhering to. I think that's so good. Some countries manage to do it better than others. Look at countries like Japan, for example. Mm-hmm. Very clear what they stand for. It's very clear that if you go to Japan, you're going to live that way of life. Countries like Dubai, for example, you know their rules, you know their values. If you want to live there, you're going to have to follow those values. We, on the other hand, are a bit wetter around the edges on those enforcing those British values and encouraging people to integrate within them.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there may be a reason for that? For example, I'd put to you as a practicing Christian and a devout Christian, the British Isles as a landmass would have been historically Druidic and pagan in some of its beliefs, and Christianity would have travelled here through the spread of the Byzantine Empire and Saxonic tribes who would have brought Western Orthodox Christianity to the country. Had they been limited to borders, would we be able to observe being a Christian nation like we are now? So I take on board what you're saying, but I'd say that, you know, one of the reasons we refer to ourselves as Anglo-Saxons is because of the fact that there were Germanic tribes that were ignorant of our borders and decided to come to the British Isles. So wouldn't that be an example of people ignoring borders, which have resulted in the betterment of this country and really the origin of the name of this nation?
Our history isn't about people ignoring borders. It's mostly about people invading borders, isn't it? We've had lots of invasions over the years, and that's why we've become the mongrel nation that we are, and there's nothing wrong with that. But mm-hmm. I think we've passed that stage of countries taking over other countries. That's a bygone era for the most part, and it's still happening somewhat in the East. But when I say we have borders, it doesn't mean people can't cross them. You know, people should be able to cross borders as long as they have the skills, talents, and knowledge that the country needs in order to thrive. It's just a border should not be completely open. And that's where we get a problem. As for this being a Christian nation, I think it's been a Christian nation long before then. But way back to like the 3rd century, we've had Christians entering this country and spreading the faith around. And then eventually, of course, it became the primary religion, and we've spread it around the world.
Where there's been a rise in atheism and agnosticism in the UK, for example, where many would argue that there is enough scientific proof to refute a lot of the claims made by Abrahamic faith systems, such as Christianity.
Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with people believing in any God or no God. What I have an issue with is people that struggle to tolerate people of different faiths and none. And I've seen a overt atheism in this country over recent years where people have a real problem with Christians in particular. It's, why do you believe in the fairy in the sky? It's like, well, it gives people comfort, and B, it gives people meaning in their lives. And if you don't believe in it, that's fine. But why does it offend you so much that other people do? I find that fascinating.
Mm-hmm. It's because people have had it kind of forced upon them, haven't they? That will be why I think a lot of people get.
Do people really get religion forced upon them these days?
I think you get it as a kid, And probably generations past, it's been more prevalent, right? Maybe that's nonsense. I'm just making that up.
Yeah, because we have a law in this country that everyone in a state school should be part of some collective worship, but I've not seen it happening for a long, long time. Assemblies very rarely even say the Lord's Prayer anymore. Everyone's so afraid of offending people of different faiths that we end up having none.
I see what you're saying about people should have the freedom of speech and expression and belief. But yeah. How far are you happy to take that if we do work towards a utopia of freedoms for everyone? Is there anywhere where you'd be like, maybe that's too free?
Yeah, but it's freedom to and freedom from are very different things. Mm-hmm. So you should be able to, in lots of ways, you should be able to say whatever you like. I don't think there should be very many limits on freedom of speech at all, and as long as it's not hurting anyone literally, as long as it's not inciting violence, and as long as it's not libeling anyone, you should be able to express your views. That's fine. Freedom of expression is a bit different if we're talking about, you mentioned, for example, trans kids. Now, it depends on the context. So if you're talking about a school setting, for example, freedom in a school setting might not be the freedom to wear whatever you like. It might be conformity in that sense, because you're free from having to decide what to wear. You're free from bullying from your peers. You're free from, if your parents can't afford decent clothes. So freedom does come with restrictions in some way, as in you're liberated through having conformity sometimes.
I think we live in incredibly treacherous times for people to communicate. And I would go back to the internet and cite the internet as a kind of way that we've kind of evolved our communication. So that even if you knew someone really well and you sent them a WhatsApp, once it's written down in that way, even if you wanted to kind of edit what you said verbally with more dialogue, it's already written down once. That person could take it and just use what you've said as no, that's the gospel of your opinion, right? But I think we are in some ways freer than we ever have been. It's just about choosing what we want to fucking do with it, isn't it? And I'm not sure what we're doing with it right now is as progressive. And I always come back to that word because I think even though there are things that... the things in your narrative that I think conflict with some of our listeners and some of our own, ideas, Calvin, I still think progression of a discussion and, humanity and civilization is pretty much what we're all in this for.
That's the problem, isn't it? Because we always assume that progress is a good thing and it's a linear path and society is always getting better through progress. But I don't think that's always the case. I think sometimes we can go too far and things can become crazy. And, we saw this with the fall of Rome.
Do you have an example of that? Because that's what I was trying to get at.
It kind of leads me to my question in today's episode, really, Calvin. I think... it's worth throwing it in now and we can broaden this conversation, which is, I like a lot of people, we kind of come across your works through your kind of, some of your appearances on GB, This Morning Britain, on ITV. I think that's fair to say that you probably got a few more eyes on you when you did that huge program. And there's some interesting stuff in the clips. They didn't clip you up, Calvin, and put you on the internet for all time. You're out there, right? You're just out there, and the one that kind of stuck with me was when the race report came out earlier this year.
Fantastic report.
And
I disagree. I've actually got it here.
I keep it just next to me.
Vehemently disagree.
But why aren't you a big believer in institutional racism? And I put that as a broad question because I think we should talk about this.
I'm just going to tack on also systematic racism as well with that, Howard, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, I guess those two things kind of can be, maybe we can work out what the difference is between institutional and systematic racism. But let's go over to Cal because I think, this is one of the things you definitely gained some notoriety for this year and talking about, Calvin.
I think it's the biggest problem with that report, actually. So the report came out and it looked at so many racial discrepancies, so many injustices and solutions to those injustices, lots of recommendations. But rather than looking through them and rather than debating them, what most people did is picked apart one little bit in the foreword, which was poorly written, that said the report didn't find any evidence of institutional racism in the areas that it looked at. And people spun that to say, this report is saying that there's no such thing as institutional racism in this country, blah, blah, blah. And that's not what it was about at all. It really frustrated me. But that was the focus of the entire week or 2 weeks around the release of the report, because there's so much good work in that report that we need to get implemented in order to make this country a better place. And people want to bicker about whether institutional racism or systemic racism exists in this country. I don't think that's helpful. You know, my belief, whether it exists or not, it doesn't really affect it. The problem we have is that it's using as an excuse. Let's not use a blanket term that is an easy excuse. Let's look at the nitty-gritty details. Let's look at which sectors have problems and how to address those problems. That's what I think we should be doing.
I mean, it's been an interesting time for the phrase institutional racism, because without wanting to, you know, just descending to an argument, but it's been pretty much proven that there was institutional racism in cricket, right?
Well, let's try a more poignant example. So the McPherson report was a report conducted by the police following the murder of Stephen Lawrence, which revealed the existence of institutional racism within the Metropolitan Police.
Yeah.
So for me, that being an example of, you know, having a confirmation of institutional racism. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's an example to discuss.
That's what people wanted, I think, Dane. I think that's all people wanted from the credit report, is confirmation of their own personal biases. They wanted people to say, yes, that is racist. But then how does that help? And how do we move on from that? The report wasn't about that. It's about, look, there's a racial injustice here in the education system. This is what we think we could do about it in order to improve the situation. And surely we all want to get to that point rather than just be able to say, yep, knew it was racist.
Well, you know? I think when you look at the pathology of addressing a problem or an issue, whether it's a social one or even a psychological one, they all say the first step is admitting you have a problem. So prior to the McPherson report, there wouldn't have been any discussion of institutional racism en masse or within mainstream media. So the revelation of that would at least be that there are maybe some people who, because they, for example, so you grew up in Mansfield, north, so that's kind of Nottinghamshire.
Yeah,
historic
yeah.
mining town. What would you say the population ballpark would have been for Black Britons there?
Very, very small. We were very, very one of the first Black families in the town.
Right. So would it stand to reason that because the inhabitants of that town would have never experienced, had any Black people around, it would be harder for them to believe in the existence of institutional racism prior to a report being published? Would that be fair to say?
I don't think it would have affected them, to be honest, in that sense.
Do you think
that's my problem? That people in the, so if I was using my town as a specific example, I don't think the term institutional racism would have been helpful in any way in that context, because it would have meant nothing to them. Whereas racism was an issue in the town. Mm-hmm. I experienced racism firsthand quite a lot growing up in a predominantly white town.
So I've heard.
Yeah, but I don't think it's. As easy as saying that there was.
Would you say that's institutional? If there's an entire town that maybe holds racist beliefs or regressive beliefs,
but
towards
that's it. I wouldn't say the town was racist. I wouldn't say the entire town was racist. I would say the many ignorant people within the town that were racist towards people that were different to them. And you find ignorance everywhere, but it doesn't make an entire town racist. And I think it's a very lovely town. I've still got family there, so I wouldn't denigrate the whole, you know what I mean?
But aren't there levels to racism? And isn't that kind of what makes this kind of, you know, the slight kind of denial that you had about it on the, you know, the way you approach talking about it kind of so controversial? Because, you know,
I've not had any denial about anything, so I'll take that and point in contention. But I do think, look, if an institution is institutionally racist, it will be set up in a way that it's harder for people of ethnic minorities, or there are more hurdles for ethnic minorities, or there's more negativity towards people of ethnic minority status.
Like British, like the cricket board, yeah? So that would be a definite thing where it's going to be proven very quickly.
That would be a good example.
Yeah, that is a good example.
Or an example would be like 70% of all business loans that are applied for by Black Britons are rejected.
Now, that would be a poor example.
And why would it be a poor example?
Because this is the core premise. This is the thing that we get a lot, is that a racial disparity is not proof of racism, right? So we saw this all throughout, you know, I'm sure you've heard the example I use many times, but people always say to me, because of the credit report, people always say, well, in the NHS, Black mothers are more likely to die in childbirth than white mothers. Therefore, the NHS is institutionally racist. And when we take a statistic like that and say, because there's a disparity due to race, it means that there's racism or the institution is racist, that doesn't help because it's incorrect. The NHS is not institutionally racist because of that. It might be because of other reasons, but it's not because of that. Likewise, I often say, well, actually, if you're a white cancer patient, you're more likely to die than if you're a black cancer patient. I don't think that cancer doctors are treating black patients different to white patients and giving them better treatment. I don't think that that doesn't work with me. The logic makes no sense. Therefore, we have to look at the disparities further rather than just a surface deep level and point a finger.
And where, if you go further, does it take you?
Exactly. So most of the time, most of these disparities come down to demographics. So whereabouts in the country you are, wealth and class are massive factors. So the disadvantage.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Areas have much more problems with NHS, with education, et cetera, for everybody, not just people of ethnic minority status. But then you look down at the demographics, you see actually, well, there are more people of ethnic minority status in these deprived areas, in the cities. And then you have to look at, well, why is that the case? So every time you look further, there's a new bit to it that needs addressing and another piece that needs fixing. Those puzzles are deep. You know, nothing in our society is as simple as saying racism. And if it was, it would be much easier to fix by now. But what that does is it gives people an excuse. And this is the problem. Because once people have an excuse, they don't have to work for themselves because they're passing the blame on something else. And life is very, very tough. Life is very, very difficult. We never get where we want to get in life. We never achieve all the goals we want to achieve in life. So if there is an easy escape clause to say, yeah, that's why, because you know the white man kept me down, that system is against me, I was never going to make it, then people are going to be held back. And I think that's a shame, a great shame.
I agree. But then I would say, going back to the previous discussion we had about borders, then does it stand to reason that maybe if the white man wasn't able to penetrate certain borders or invade them, then, for example, indigenous Africans would be able to take advantage of the resources that are native to their own lands, for example?
I don't see how that's relevant to today at all. And that's
well, I mean, you know,
the problem with that is we go back far enough. You can say, well, this person invaded that person, that country invaded that person. You know, everyone goes back to, well, the white man did this and slavery that. And we don't talk about actually, there were many African tribe leaders that were enforcing slavery a lot longer in Africa before the white man even turned up to the continent and continued throughout.
We're confusing indentured servitude with chattel slavery because, well, I know, but I'm saying
today.
Well, the fact that following the end of chattel slavery, all taxpayers, both black and white, would have had to continue to pay compensation up until as recently as 2017. Now, I would argue that while I want to not remain blaming chattel slavery for any shortcomings I may have in my life, I think it stands to reason that if I wasn't subject to a policy whereby I had to pay the captors of my ancestors for them losing slaves, I probably would have had a more capital to begin my life with. I think it's fair to say.
That's not true, and it's a negative spin. I think it's a fantastic thing that this country was instrumental in ending slavery on a global scale.
But that's also not true. It cost this country a lot of money, a lot of men. But that's not true though. That this country was instrumental in ending slavery. I'd say there are several other factors. For example, the Haitian Revolution, industrialization, which should have led to the end of slavery. And I'm saying, following that, like, me still paying or my family still paying compensation to lost these victims when I've had no direct benefit from that up until 2017 doesn't really sound like a progressive policy that would allow me not to blame the white man if he's still taking my money. You know, you yourself you've campaigned for defunding the BBC, which is tax funded. Well, you know, that's another example of, you know, tax funding the progressive another person who's in a higher socioeconomic group to myself, who probably doesn't need the money Whereas, you know, if I was able to keep that money, I probably would have done better as myself and have less people to blame, is what I'm saying.
I think tax, I'm all for less tax for everybody. I think tax is a bloody disgusting thing. It's terrible. But I don't see how
taxation systems also, like universal taxation systems, would have arguably been another way to oppress, you know, like you mentioned, working class minorities or people from impoverished backgrounds. So I think it does stand to reason that, like, with regressive institutions, whether it, they are a result of racism or classism, if those do inhibit the personal or economic progress of a group of people, that's a reason they're going to be held back. So it's not really blaming the white man, but it's still a policy which, irrespective of race, has held a lot of people back. Isn't that not fair to say?
No, I don't agree at all.
How come?
The policy you're talking about in particular, in that there was a massive payment to end slavery. I think that's probably a good thing if we're stopping slavery. I think that's probably a positive for the world and for this country. It cost us a lot of money, but we did it because we had to do it. I think it's very negative to spin that around to saying, oh, I didn't want to have to pay for someone that lived a high life hundreds of years ago. I mean, if we...
That's not 100 years ago. It's up until 2017. That's 4 years ago, I'm saying.
No longer exist.
But as a taxpayer, up as recently as 4 years ago, I am paying people who would have already made billions from being slave owners in the first place. And my only argument is, I am paid. Yeah, this is a documented fact that
That were paid off are all dead.
Well, their estate is still paid off up until 2017. So who's that money going to?
The debt is paid off. So right now, the money you're paying goes to the government, goes to our debts, our national debts.
Well, the government would have also benefited from slavery as well. Surely. They would have been actively involved in the slave trade, and so they're still benefiting from it, despite posturing as if they've ended it. I feel like the idea of slavery is to use labor for capital or labor exploitation for capital. So if you still have taxpayers paying capital towards you, that's still exploitation, and they're still benefiting from the after effects of slavery, as opposed to people that may be descended from people that are enslaved.
So you feel like you're enslaved?
I feel like... Well, using your example of taxation, I think if I'm paying tax towards people who already benefited from myself, my ancestors, and money still go to their estate, to the government.
Where does that money go?
Well, that's a good question. Where does
it go? You make it sound like you personally are giving money to some rich white man who's keeping you down. That's not the case at all. When we pay our taxes, it's the public funds that is paying for your hospital, paying for your roads, paying for your national debt.
Also paying for their banker bailout. So you had private companies like, you know, Goldman Sachs, where Rishi Sunak would have sat as a board of directors, who then ratified a bailout, and then my tax money went to bail out institutions which are supposed to be parts of free markets that are historically owned by rich white men, where these institutions would have been initially founded on slavery. That's where stocks, you know, stocks and trades, the initial stock would have been chattel slaves, and the money that had risen by that allowed for America to become a hegemony over the world. And that only ended with the introduction of the cotton gin by other white industrialists as well. And as a result of that, I've had to pay compensation in the form of taxation up until 2017. And I'm saying, along the lines of your logic as well, taxation as an idea is terrible, particularly I feel when I have to pay that same financial restitution to people who have already made money historically from my ancestor suffering.
How much have you paid, Dana? How much has it held you back?
I mean, I can't even... I only found out that we paid compensation until 2017, but yeah. What would you say would be an acceptable number for me to pay towards former slave owners? Because I'd say the answer's zero. So even if I paid £1,
You're not paying anything towards a former slave owner. There are no former slave owners in this country. You're paying national debt, you're paying taxation, which is a shared public fund. We've got past that point. You're not paying any rich white man who used to own slaves or any of his ancestors.
Because if I've paid towards a banker bailout, anyone who's paid tax and their money's gone towards bailing out banks as a result of a financial crisis has paid towards predominantly rich white men.
It's a very interesting stance that I've not actually heard articulated in this way before, but it feels to me very harmful to you because you seem to be stuck in this, and I hate to use the word victimhood mentality, but it seems to be like, you know, you feel somehow held back or somehow deprived of something.
For a better word, let's say shortchanged. I think I agree with your point where you said about taxation goes towards municipal services such as universal healthcare, which is itself slowly becoming privatized. Or, you know,
I'm not in favour of poor people giving money to rich people.
That's my point. With your point that, you know, poor people shouldn't have to pay taxation towards making rich people richer. And I'm saying within that You could, I mean, it's a statistical fact that Black Britons, for example, are overrepresented within the poverty line within this country. Is that fair to say?
But again, if you're going to take that disparity and turn that into a causation, then I'd say no.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that the causation of them being overrepresented in poverty is a result of them being Black, but I'm saying that is just circumstantial. And I'm saying, yes, by that same token, they would make up the same tax base as, you know, a working class white person that has also equally paid towards financial relief for people that initially profited from the slave trade. And I'm saying then, it not makes me a victim, but I feel like I'm shortchanged. I'm speaking from, like, even in this particular instance, I'm talking from an economic perspective that if we're in a free market, how can we have a system whereby a socialist institution like tax pays for a private institution like investment banking?
Yeah. Well, thankfully, that debt has been paid off, so you're not going to be paying it anymore. I'm sorry that it's upset you and you didn't, I mean, I'm sure you can get a refund on your £5 or whatever that it was that you contributed towards it.
I mean, I think it might be more than £5 just from the natural merit of it being taxed. Like, and even yourself, like, you know, that's, it's all like, you know.
So would you be in favor of reparations then, Dan?
It depends what you define as reparations. So, just as money being paid back to me by the government for slavery, do you mean?
Yeah.
It might not be as simple as just money, because I would argue that money has its owners and money is subject to hyperinflation and the valuation of money can change. And so just giving people money may not be particularly profitable. But I would say that there are certain institutions, like, for example, maybe a concessions for tax for the descendants of continental Africans would be a good method of reparations. If the idea is not to be a victim and for everyone, you know, to be able to observe the opportunity to exploit, to aspire to their creative potential, then I would say maybe I shouldn't pay as much tax as most people because I've had to pay. Well, because
you're brown.
Hmm?
Because you're brown.
No, but because I don't believe in taxation and I should have the freedom of expression.
Believe in tax should pay tax.
Yeah. That's how our faith system works.
You're conflating so many different things, though. The taxation system is problematic, I give you that, but you seem to be winding it into race somehow. Everything comes, it gets wound into race. I find it fascinating. I don't know how the two are intertwined.
I mean, well, I would say that taxation, the realization that you could have a universal tax base, which means that everyone has to pay, could be more profitable than indentured servitude or slavery in a world of industrialization. So that's the way I'd say they conflate, is that I imagine at some point those people who have been initially profiting from labor exploitation of slaves and chattel slaves, with the rise of industrialization, it meant that there were machines and automation that could do the job for longer and better than your former chattel slaves. And I think a lot of governments would have realized that if they have everybody paying tax en masse, it would have probably resulted in being even more profitable than indentured servitude, in the same way that still allows, that continues to exist alongside the penal industrial complex, for example. So the reason why I guess they all conflate is because I guess this is all predicated on the idea that chattel slavery was the basis that allowed for the West to rise as a capitalist superpower, economic superpower through capitalism. Because of all the free labor and all of the capital that came in, it means that all of these financial systems that have followed in the West are all linked to what the benefits that slavery provided for enslavers. So I guess that's why it kind of conflates. Sorry.
And Dane, I was just going to say, this is probably an opportune moment to pose your question, which is, you know, this narrative of this episode is intertwined. And I know you were kind of going to ask something that I think feeds into what we're discussing here.
Just following the previous question, you've said that, you know, it appears that I'm kind of angry, or others appear to have a issue of victimhood as a brown person, which has affected my opportunity for economic progress or to realise my human potential, and that, you know, these shouldn't be drawbacks to my personal progress. But I'd say that there are several instances other than, like, you know, paying compensation. I would have said that, you know, there are issues like a number of people who have been members of the Commonwealth and have lived and worked in the UK following the Windrush being forcibly deported under mistaken, under mistaken information, and then dying in absentia and not receiving any compensation would hold somebody back, because we have systems whereby we're supposed to remunerate people if we make mistakes of a civil nature, but people haven't been repaid. So I would say that would be an example. I'd say an example being, like, you know, 1,476 deaths in police custody since 1990 and not one conviction. can also impede people's personal progress. The failure to discuss critical race theory would also be, you know, because like I said, it's theory rather than fact. So the lack of willingness to discuss critical race theory seems questionable and kind of regressive, because it should, you know, based on the first discussion we had, freedom of expression would mean if people want to expunge a particular theory, they should have the freedom to do so. But a lot of people deny that. So I guess I'm saying, and I'm sure I've made it very clear, I know racism is alive and well in the UK and globally, and has inextricable links to capitalism, which you may dispute at points. So I was wondering if you could give me examples where you've observed the most racial harmony within the UK, which would refute the claims that are made by many people that institutional racism and systematic racism not only exists here, but also impedes the progress of people of colour or people from ethnic minorities. So is there any clear example of racial harmony which you could see is directly progressive to encouraging racial harmony within the UK?
Okay, good question. I'll try and break apart all of that you just said. So starting with compensation and reparations, the reason I don't think that would work is because we'd essentially have poor black people paying money to rich black people, because the moment we say the government needs to give money to people, it's not the government's money, it's our money, unless we discuss, we don't like taxation. Moving on to a lot of these links to the past, a lot of historic trauma, so to speak, and things that might have some links to us today, might not. I find that very interesting.
Can I give you an example of historic trauma, just a context? John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he begat his only son, and whoever should believe in him should have eternal life, who suffered on the cross because he was crucified under Pontius Pilate, suffered death and was buried. 2021 years later, that example of historic trauma is the basis for the entirety of a whole religious group for most of the people on this planet. So I think sometimes historic trauma can be very relevant, because we replicate it every Sunday.
Only when you use it for good. That's the problem. When you stick with it and use it for negative, use it for an excuse, use it to hold you down, that's the problem. A lot of this is about holding people back. So a lot of it is, so the examples you use, for example, Windrush, that was a terrible government policy. It was disgusting, a massive mistake. I think they've apologized for it. They should do. I don't think I know anyone that would agree with that policy. However, how did it affect you personally? What has held you back personally? You seem to take a lot of gripes with these things. Deaths in police custody, always wrong. Whenever someone dies in police custody, always wrong. White men tend to die the most in police custody. It's not an issue of race. It's an issue of injustice. And we should all be fighting for injustice. Critical race theory, this inability to discuss it. I think all we do is discuss critical race theory. I've discussed critical race theory more in this past 18 months than I have anything else, to be honest.
May I ask your definition of critical race theory, just so we have context?
Critical race theory is the theory of critical race. It's from American academia. It was originally actually an idea in law to look at racial injustices in a context of law, and got expanded beyond academia, beyond law, to look at wider society and looking at situations through a racial lens and trying to solve injustices in race, in racial inequalities. But I think it's flawed for many reasons that I've talked about in other outlets, but we certainly do discuss it quite a lot. I actually think it's very divisive. I think it's making things worse. I think it's people that use it tend to be well-intentioned, but misguided.
Do you think that same kind of variance on the understanding of, or the expression of the theory, is very similar to like denominations of the church, for example, because you have Catholics, you have Protestants, you have Lutherans, you have Jehovah's Witnesses, you have Seventh-day Adventists, even though they may have variations on the theory on Jesuit theory, I'm sure you'd argue that as long as they do believe in centered God and Jesus Christ and their beliefs, they still have the right to exist. Is that not fair to say?
Everyone has a right to exist, sure.
Oh, no, the ideology to exist and to be able to be examined and expressed.
I've never said we shouldn't examine it, never said we shouldn't
discuss it. So you think critical race theory can still exist in academic institutions and should be discussed?
It should only be discussed in academic institutions, in my opinion. But
I think it's the only place it's been discussed so far.
It's been discussed all over the media. It's been discussed in schools. It's been discussed everywhere, in politics, in the Houses of Commons. It's been discussed everywhere. To say it's only been discussed in academia is disingenuous, rather. But the problem with CRT is that I said it shouldn't be taught in schools as fact. And this is what the Equalities Minister said. This is what the Department of Education has said too. Because the problem there is that we have young black kids being told they're victims, they're held back, they're oppressed, and that's self-perpetuating, because we tell people that often enough, they will believe it. And we have white kids who are being told, your parents or your ancestors were bad people, and therefore you are bad people, and somehow you are privileged. And I get that other people who are watching this might have different descriptions of what white privilege means, in that I think it means that, you know, white people are somehow privileged, but I get that other people think it means that it, being white doesn't means that the color of your skin doesn't hold you back. But even that is incorrect, and I've disproved that many times. So all of this is very harmful. It's divisive. It's not helping social cohesion. And that should surely be something we're all working towards. And you mentioned at the end of your question, do we have anywhere where we have social harmony in this country? I think in general, we do have social harmony in this country. In general, it's a multi-ethnic country. I spent 15 years living in London, and we have people from all backgrounds, all races, all religions getting on, for the most part, quite well. We all have equality under the law. Not everything is perfect. It's not a completely meritocratic society, but we can all pretty much get wherever we want to be as long as we work hard enough. And that's the message that we should all be sending.
What do you think the biggest contributor to the social and racial cohesion in a place like London has been? As again, going back to your discussion about borders, I think the fact that, you know, London has become a melting pot because of, you know, immigration policy initially has probably allowed for there to be more social cohesion. So if we do have stringent borders and stringent border control, how would we be able to still continue to observe social cohesion if we have examples like watching 27 people die on a dinghy trying to get to the country as asylum seekers, or we have the Windrush scandal where people who have been living in the country for years are dying in absentia due to administrative errors, or, you know, legislation like the 1982 Immigration Act that Margaret Thatcher said, where if your grandparents aren't British, then neither are you. Like, how can any of these policies aid towards continuing social cohesion?
Very easily. So control borders is not the opposite of open borders. Closed borders is the opposite of open borders, and that's not what anyone's suggesting. Control is very important. We need to know who's coming in this country. We need to prevent terrorists from coming into the country. We need to make sure that people coming in have the skills, talents, and knowledge that we need in order to make the country thrive and to make the country grow. And we need to make sure that people coming into the country are going to adhere to or subscribe to British values and bring their own culture with them, absolutely, but take on board ours too and not want to destroy it and not want to destroy us. I think that's very important. So I really struggle when people say, oh, controlling borders is racist, xenophobic, or somehow against open borders.
Is it because of the criteria that kind of is included in the border controls, in that, for example, there is nobody who would, in fact, a lot of South Africans who would have repatriated in the UK were given financial assistance to do so, as well as like a lot of white Britons were given financial aid to be able to settle in places like Australasia. Whereas, you know, continental Africans and members of the Asian diaspora haven't been able to enjoy those same freedoms. So I'm not sure if...
What do you mean? You think we should give people money to settle here?
Well, I mean, if they're British people and it's worked... No, as in... How come some people are able to do so and some people aren't given money to settle here and some people aren't given money to settle here?
I don't think anyone should be given money to settle here. I think if people want to move to the United Kingdom, they should be able to support themselves. And the problem is we have too many people that are ready to move here because it's such a good welfare system. The people are coming over the channel, which you mentioned. They shouldn't be at risk of dying in the channel. They shouldn't be crossing those dangerous waters in a dinghy. They don't need to. They're already in a free country. They're already in the United States of Europe, for goodness sake. You don't need to escape France to get to Britain. The reason people are doing so is because they have free healthcare over here. They get probably a free hotel. They get given a mobile phone and money to live on. They get free universal credit. They get all, you know, so many good things that we're giving away to people for no reason.
Do you think these are all good things that make you a good or happy person? I ask within the context of you being a believer in God. Do you think money and mobile phones and they're nice things?
No, they're not good things. They're nice things. They're attractive things. And if you're not getting free things in one place and you see free things being given away in another place, of course you're going to go to that other place. What we need to do instead is make sure that these places they're escaping are improved and better and help people with nation building where they live rather than just having a free-for-all.
How's it gone with the whole nation building?
Not very well, because we're not doing it properly. It's terrible.
Yeah, it's not. We haven't proven to be too great at that one, have we?
Is there anybody you think, a figurehead you think you could blame for the poor diplomacy
we've had. Why is it always such a negative outtake? Why are we always looking for someone to blame or something?
Well, it's not culpability. Okay, let's not look at it from fault. So not culpability, responsibility. Because we do appoint people and figureheads for these specific tasks and we do salarize them with our own money. So, you know, speaking as someone who also believes in the idea of free economy or free commerce, as a customer, if I pay for a service, I expect that service to be done to the most optimal level. So don't look at it from blame, but I have delegated as a taxpayer and as a civilian, the responsibility of diplomacy and foreign policy to somebody else. So if they have underperformed, am I not, as a free citizen, able to scrutinize them? I wouldn't say it's negative.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. Is there not someone that we should be scrutinizing for our foreign policy, creating hostile environments that require people to seek asylum from?
I don't think we have an hostile environment, but yes, we should be.
No, I mean the hostile environments that people leave in order to seek asylum in the UK, for example.
Yeah, we should be holding all of them accountable. And if anyone is to blame, it's us. If anyone's to blame, it's you. You voted for these people.
I didn't vote for these people.
Calvin,
I didn't vote for these people.
That's how democracy works. We get the people we vote for. If you want a better politician, either vote for a better politician or stand yourself.
Well, that is actually on the agenda one day, Dane. It would be interesting. No, it's a no from Dane.
At this particular point.
It's really, because we sit there moaning about the calibre of our politicians, but stand up. Anyone can vote for election in this country. I've done it myself.
But doesn't it cost £1,000 for you to form your own political party?
No.
How did it go for you when you ran?
Loved it. Absolute greatest time of my life. Fantastic.
Why was it the greatest time of your life? That's a fascinating statement before we wrap today's episode.
I was on the ground with everyday folk, finding out what matters to people, what they care about, what they wanted help with, and just working with people on a local level. It was amazing. You don't get to do that very often because we're siloed in our different industries or doing whatever we need to do to survive. Just being with the people was great.
That's interesting. It's been an interesting episode, hey Dane. I think we've had proper discourse. I hope that it hasn't been shouty nonsense. But you must get a lot of shouty nonsense, Calvin.
No. People like to shout. I just sit back and let them get on with it, and then when they're finished, I'll say my bit if they want me to say it. If they don't, fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, Calvin, I feel like we've only scratched the surface.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of lattices and a lot of threads that may have been conflated that I think you and I could dissect. And so I hope this is the beginning of a much larger conversation. And I think we've...
Really, it's so difficult. It's because we have... It's applicable to me and you, but it's applicable to so many people in society these days that we see the world through very, very different lens. We've lost... It comes back to social cohesion, I suppose. We've lost a united lens, and it's very, very difficult to get down to the core nuance because we're looking at the surface from different angles, and it's really challenging. Even, you know, you said, how do you define CLT? And I assume the reason you asked that question is because you might have had a different definition if I'd have given my definition. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with everything, you know, with race. We don't even agree with what racism means anymore. We can't get to the crux of the matter because we're stuck on the surface. That's a problem in our society.
Yeah, and I feel like I would argue that social cohesion requires ongoing discourse. And I think that theories, whether they are social, theological, economic, always should be reviewed. Methodology should always be tested, and new ideas and conclusions should be formed based on the testing. But I think that that's not going to happen unless people are open to be responsible for those findings. So again, as I say, it's been a good conversation, can't lie. And I've enjoyed having this conversation, but I feel like it's just the beginning of a much longer one. And I think, you know,
will you come back, Calvin? Would you come back?
Would you come back?
Yeah, always happy to chat. Yeah, anytime.
Well, I think chatting is a I think we can both agree is a historic British value that would be very beneficial for social cohesion. If I could,
usually with a cup of tea.
With a cup of tea.
Okay,
I'm more of a green tea person, but also, you know, tea doesn't come from this country, so.
Oh gosh, that's the great thing. That's the great thing about Britain, isn't it? We have adapt things from other cultures because we're very happy to do that. We're not xenophobic in any way like that.
And I would say that I again agree. That's maybe one of the better things about the British Commonwealth is that it's this synchronicity of various other gifts from other cultures that makes Britain great.
Yeah, we popularized tea. We might not have created it, but we popularized it.
Well, the Japanese may have something to say about that as well, but that's another conversation for another time. Thanks again, Calvin. Could you please tell the listeners where they could find out more about your works and narrative and where they can hear more about you?
I suppose tune into GB News if you dare.
Fucking hell. It's the first time anyone said that on this podcast, but there you go.
Yeah, read the Telegraph, read the Daily Mail. You can always follow me on Twitter at Calvin Robinson until I get cancelled from there on all the social media channels. Just type my name in Google. I don't know.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so check that out. And I think, as I said, Calvin, I think it's been a very healthy discussion, but I definitely think it's one that needs to continue because I think, yeah, a lot of the time, effective debate cannot be done in the space of 280 characters or within IG Live. So if you're willing, I think we should continue the discussion.
Can we give a shout out to Katie Stevenson as well for making
it happen? Yeah, shout out Katie Stevenson for making it happen from the old school friend and stuff who did it for you. And yeah, thank you very much, Calvin.
Thank you.
God bless.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guest was Calvin Robinson. You can follow Calvin on Twitter at Calvin Robinson or on Instagram at Calvin Robinson. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at The Howard Cohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at We Are Audio Culture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks for listening, guys, and remember, question everything.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.